On Tuesday, April 23rd at 6 p.m., the DSR Network and the New Republic will be co-hosting an evening featuring a conversation with Secretary of Transportation Pete Buttigieg. The event will take place at the National Press Club. If you are a member and live or will be in the D.C. area and would like to attend, please email Riley Fessler at rmfessler@trgmedia.com. That's rmfessler@trgmedia.com. We have a few seats still available and would love to see you there.
This is the Daily Blast from the New Republic, produced and presented by the DSR Network. I'm your host, Greg Sargent. At a fundraiser with oil and gas industry executives last week, Donald Trump repeatedly ranted angrily about, of all things, wind power, the Washington Post reports. As Trump put it to the executives, "I hate wind." That may seem like low comic relief, but it actually gets at a deadly serious topic. If Trump is re-elected president, he'd very likely try to repeal President Biden's climate policies. What would the consequences of this be? The topic is almost never discussed. So today we're talking to David Roberts, who writes a great Substack about energy called Volts, to try to game it all out. Welcome, David. Really glad to have you on today.
Hey, Greg. Glad to be here.
So we had Trump's rants about wind power, and he often rages about specific green energy alternatives and policies that combat global warming. Reuters reports that Trump would likely try to reverse Biden's climate agenda, including the Inflation Reduction Act, which spends hundreds of billions of dollars to subsidize the transition to technologies like wind, solar, and electric vehicles, and tailpipe regulations that encourage manufacturers to move to EVs. Is there any reason to doubt that Trump would do this?
Well, it depends a little bit on what you mean by this. I mean, I think we should all acknowledge up front that it's extremely unpredictable what Trump might do. So it's hard to say. And there are many pieces of the Biden climate agenda, too. So it's really hard to say. Like, my sense from Trump himself is that he doesn't, I mean, this is probably true on all issues, but I don't think he has any sort of original direct thoughts about climate change or clean energy. I don't think it matters to him at all. I just think occasionally, like, the wind farm got in the way of his golf course in Scotland that one time, and that lodged in his little pea brain somewhere, and now he hates wind. But I don't think there's anything principled about it. Like, I don't think he knows anything about wind. I don't think he knows anything about wind policy or anything like that. So all of which is just to say, I mean, like what we saw in his first regime, you know, everybody forgets that he was already president once. So we can kind of look back.
We lived through it. I was there.
I know. I completely understand everyone trying to forget. But so you know, there are some areas of policy where he cares and gets involved. Like, he loves tariffs. He hates China. He loves Russia. You know, there are some things where he'll get personally involved. But when it came to like the EPA, he just put, you know, Scott Pruitt, the oil guy, in charge, and then, you know, just let Scott Pruitt run crazy. He didn't care one way or the other. So it sort of depends. The only reason I'm prefacing all this is that the tax credits that are at the core of the IRA, tax credits have proven surprisingly resilient over the years. Clean energy tax credits, like, they have survived Republican regimes before. They have come and gone through Republican regimes before, I think, because, you know, just handing out money to big developers is and creating jobs in often red and purple states is something that, although they're quiet about it, they don't mind that much. So I think there is some chance, even though, you know, like the hardcore people at Project 25 or whatever, at the Heritage Institute, they want to nuke all of it. But there's enough business backing for the core tax credits that I think maybe they could survive the process. Everything else is doomed. That's what I guess is what I would say. Like, you know, there's like billions of dollars going out the door of EPA right now, going out the door of DOE, going out IRS to, you know, specifically to environmental justice communities, all that kind of stuff, all those grants, you know, all the R&D, all this kind of stuff, that would all get nuked. There's some chance the core tax credits might survive, I guess.
Well, let's talk about the IRA for a second before we get on to the other disasters that could ensue. It's being implemented, resulting in a kind of manufacturing renaissance in green energy, a lot of it focused in red states, as you mentioned before. And the transition to EVs seems to be on track, though the IRA may be falling a bit short in other areas, right? While its subsidies are making solar and wind cheaper, the transition is getting bogged down a bit by bureaucratic hurdles and local political opposition and so forth. What's your overall reading right now, sort of simplified, on where we are with Biden's policies and how well they're doing in terms of moving the transition to decarbonization?
Well, I think the way to think about it is that IRA was never, even its architects would tell you, was never a comprehensive climate policy. You just can't pass comprehensive climate policy through the budget reconciliation process that was used to pass IRA. All you can do through budget reconciliation is spend or raise money. And so they have spent a lot of money, you know, so there's a lot of money going out the door and it's doing what money can do, which is battering down a lot of barriers. But there is a whole other set. I mean, you need some sticks with your carrots, right? You need some limits and you need to do something about permitting, something about the excess of environmental review, something about the interconnection process. There are all these sort of more granular problems that still need legislative solutions. So it's like they built half a machine and it's chugging along as best it can, but more policy is needed to make it into a complete package, which is why one of the reasons a second Biden term is so important, that he can sort of finish the job and do, you know, fill in the holes with EPA regulations and DOE and stuff like that. So it's doing as well as it could be expected to do, but these are real, the constraints are real. But as you say, EVs, despite the sort of bizarrely negative tone that media has taken around EVs lately, I mean, really bizarrely, obsessively negative tone that you see in media around EVs, EVs are growing like gangbusters. They're growing along basically what the models said they would do. And all of that activity, all of that manufacturing activity is in like the Southeast and the Midwest. I mean, it's just flooding, like Georgia is getting, you know, like multiple new battery factories, tens of thousands of new jobs, which is why I say there's some chance the basic tax credits could survive, because it's hard to ignore that. And, you know, you get sort of like, I think it's really instructive to think about Texas right now. So like the Texas legislature is as anti-renewable, pro-fossil fuel as you could possibly get. Like they're fully Fox-pilled there in the Texas legislature. But Texas policy is the closest you're going to find to sort of an actual competitive energy market in the U.S. And it turns out, in an actual competitive energy market, wind and solar are crushing. Texas has more wind and solar than anywhere else now. Like, well, especially solar. It's like it's number one in installed utility scale solar now, even though Texas legislators hate it, just because that's the economics. So it's a question of like, Texas legislators might hate it, but do they hate it so much that they're actually going to intervene and cripple the economy of their state to thwart it? So, you know, like seeing how that plays out, I think, is a good preview into the larger Republican dilemma if Trump wins this time. There's just a lot of good economic policy. So my guess is like it'll be, you know, there'll be nothing systemic about it. Like some of the tax credits that favor Republican states will survive. Everything else will get hacked. There will be no plan. There will be no larger coordination. It'll just be a matter of like which corrupt, you know, sort of which interests are in Trump's ear or in the Republican legislature's ear at a given moment. So it'll just devolve into sort of crony capitalism, I think, is what will happen if Republicans win.
you know, supporting your point, the Post report on Trump's rants about wind essentially said that he's basically promising oil and gas executives that he'd throw bureaucratic hurdles in the way of the wind industry. And so I think that's right. You'd have this kind of patchwork where certain types of subsidies survive if they're going to red states, and other sort of corrupt bureaucratic machinations are used to cripple industries that are out of favor.
Remember, in his first term, he was going to revive coal. I don't know if people remember that, but he was promising, flat out, giving speeches to coal miners saying, I will revive the coal industry. And of course, like, it's just continued to decline. So, like, one of the main questions, and I know you've covered this a lot and written about this a lot, and this is sort of like the big question on everybody's mind. One of the reasons he didn't revive the coal industry in his first term is just that he tried to do so through the mechanisms of the bureaucracy, and the bureaucracy works pretty slowly, and it involves lots of like peer review and community feedback, and it's just difficult to do transparently stupid, corrupt things through this big bureaucracy. So the question for the second term is he going to so infuse the bureaucracy with his loyalists and dismantle the bureaucracy to an extent that he will be able to do the crazy stuff that he had trouble doing his first term? And if that's the case, then like, who knows? You know, we're off to the races. It's very difficult to predict what would happen after.
Yeah. And by the way, I would point out that this refers back to what you said earlier, that he tends to outsource policy, right? And so right. In the first term, he outsourced a lot of economic policy to the kind of Paul Ryans in Congress and the plutocrats and so forth, who just wanted to repeal Obamacare and cut taxes for the rich. But now right. It does look as if he's really getting ready to outsource a lot of policy to these kind of maniacal groups that want to take over the deep state and turn it toward their own ends. So I think there's a lot to worry about here. I mean, let me ask you this, though. The U.S. has currently pledged under the Paris Agreement to achieve a 50% reduction below 2005 carbon emission levels by 2030. There was a recent analysis by Carbon Brief that found that a Trump presidency could mean we only attain around half of that reduction. People I've talked to think that might be a bit alarmist. What do you think? Is that crazy?
I mean, this is the thing, is like, the only honest answer to that is no one knows. The only honest answer, I mean, Carbon Brief, I think the people who did that analysis will tell you that it's just like, you just have to make a whole series of assumptions about what he would do. And it's very hard to predict what he would do. So I literally have no idea. I literally have no idea how competent he would be, how competent his bureaucracy would be in undoing these things, how, you know, it's really, really hard to tell. I will say this, though. I mean, it's, you know, there's kind of a faux precision in trying to put a number on the amount of tons at work here. But I will say this, though, passing the IRA, and I heard Australia's Minister of Energy say this flat out. He said, IRA is the biggest thing that's ever happened in international climate, including the Paris Agreement. I heard him say that to an audience. So it's really hard to overstate how much IRA has galvanized other countries, how much it has spurred other countries into action. Canada, Japan, like, you see other countries trying to scramble and catch up. They're like, oh, the race is on, like, we're doing this. So even if bits and pieces of the tax credit survived and bits and pieces, you know, stumbled on, the gestalt would be, we're done with this. We're done with IRA. We're done with the transition. We don't care about clean energy. And I think that would have an incredibly deflating effect internationally, which is really what's important. Like, the U.S.'s direct emissions are not the biggest deal here. The biggest deal here is making things cheap, inspiring other countries to greater ambition. It's the international influence that's the most important thing here. And that would be, you know, like, of all the horrible things he would do internationally, that would just be a piece of it, you know, allying with Russia and cozying up with dictators and absolutely letting the air out of the tires of this sort of climate momentum we have going now.
And that leads me to something I wanted to ask you about, which is that there's a way of understanding Trump's approach here that needs more discussion, right? Trump calls climate change a hoax, but he isn't just a climate change denier. He's what you might call a fossil fuel militant, which is something else entirely, right? The idea is that not only is it our God-given right to burn as much in fossil fuels as we want, this is also an affirmative good. It makes our country stronger, whereas using green energy is inherently a symbol or a symptom of national weakness and decline. Think about it. Like, everything he says points that way. Like the weird hatred of wind power, the frequent refrain that transitioning to EVs makes us vulnerable to China, his idea that exporting more fossil fuels makes us, quote unquote, energy independent and therefore intrinsically more mighty and powerful. What do you think of this concept of fossil fuel militants? It kind of, what you're talking about really is a piece of that, right? Like this idea that he would actively want to send that deflating message to the world. It's not an incidental thing. It's something that is an act of good in his mind.
Well, I'm always leery, as you know, Greg, I'm always leery in ascribing beliefs to Trump. I mean, full stop. Like, a belief is something, if you mean belief, is something that's like derived from evidence and is stable from moment to moment or situation to situation. I don't know that he has beliefs. He has teams. He has his people and the people who are against him, right? He has my people, I and my people are dominating, or them and their people are dominating. And in his head, fossil fuels are on his team, and not just in his head. In reality, fossil fuels are on his team. So he will absolutely go to bat for fossil fuels, not out of any consideration of like larger geopolitical, you know, 12-dimensional chess or whatever, just because those are the buddies that are in his office filling his head with flattery. Like, that's, they're on his team. So, yes.
Well, also, though, David, yeah, in addition to that, though, right, like on some level, he really does see the coal miners and the people who manufacture cars, fossil fuel guzzling cars, not EVs, as being on his team as well, right? Like, that's there's a coding aspect and a cultural aspect to this that's kind of key too.
Yes, definitely. And in the background of all this is what they call petro masculinity. That's a real thing. It's a real theme. Once you start noticing it, you see it everywhere. This notion that sort of fossil fuels are like active, manly, and strong, and there's something sort of weak and passive about just sitting back and waiting for the sun to come to you. You know what I mean? Like, there's something feminine coded about renewable energy and masculine coded about fossil fuels. That's a real thing. And insofar as Trump's sort of like, you know, lizard brain is very sensitive to those signals, he absolutely echoes that stuff.
Oh, yeah. And you actually see interesting efforts to counter that when you've probably seen the ads that have been run for electric vehicles that really try to...
Oh, for sure.
Soup
for
up sure. The machismo there. Like, they have like really, yes, you know, strong guitar riffs, hard rock guitar riffs.
Yes, and that's why they're starting, right, with a Hummer. That's why they're making an electric Hummer, which is the stupidest, just like this, like apart from the Cybertruck, the stupidest vehicle that I've ever seen produced. Yeah, I think that's right. And, you know, this is probably a whole different pod topic, but I think that's a little silly. I don't think you're ever going to get that on your side, but who knows? I mean, that's a sociological discussion. We'll see. But that's definitely motivating this notion that fossil fuels have dominated the sort of notion of masculinity. That's motivating all of EV, not just advertising, but the way that US automakers are entering the EV market. It's all big, masculine, fast. You know, there's just no, like, where's my station wagon? Like, where's my minivan? You know, it's very telling that there's no EV minivan in the US, even though that is the single most useful vehicle on the road. It's all macho stuff. And so we'll see. Like, maybe they're right and that's the way to open the wedge, but it seems all kind of silly to me.
Well, you're getting at something about the politics of this issue that's endlessly frustrating, right? So right now our oil and natural gas production are at record levels, and at the same time our carbon emissions are declining. You'd think that this is something that middle of the road voters in the industrial and Appalachian heartlands would like. You have new green energy manufacturing jobs, and these are, by the way, jobs which are advanced manufacturing for people without college degrees, which I've heard is an important thing to populists, that you also have a decline in emissions. And I think most moderate voters think that's good. They don't think it's weak. They think emissions are bad and fewer emissions, you know, better. And without it hurting domestic industries, right? So right now, the current state of things is something Biden could go out and sell as a fairly major victory. But Trump just dumbs it all down to fossil fuels equals strength while green energy equals weakness. is there a way to win the argument against that?
Well, as you know, Greg, we're not really having arguments, are we? We're not really exchanging evidence and arguments. Like with this, the reality has a tenuous connection at best to our discourse and to political opinions. I mean, the entirety of the areas of the country that you're talking about is 100% captured by right-wing media, and right-wing media is not telling that story at all. So it hardly matters whether you could win an argument if you could get people to see that. You just can't get people to see that. So it's like, it's very frustrating. You have Biden out bragging about record oil and gas production. The people who would care and give him credit for that don't ever hear it, right? The only people who are hearing it are the people who don't want him to do that. You know, it's just a classic. It's just like when Democrats try to be tough on the border, like they don't get any credit from Republicans. All they do is alienate the people in their own. You know what I mean? This sort of notion that we're going to out tough Republicans, I think is silly. It is a good, I mean, objectively, it's a great story. Yes.
Right. So, but think about this, right? I totally agree with you about the utter disaster that our information environment has become, right? But so take, I was just recently driving through the Mahoning Valley on the way to seeing the eclipse in Cleveland. And the right-wing talk radio out there, man, is just off the charts. Right. But this is also a place where Lordstown is, right? Lordstown, Ohio, which is a town where Trump went to promise that he would, you know, he said famously as president, he said, I'll bring all that you buy a new house. All the jobs are coming back here. Right. And of course, and then the GM plant in Lordstown closed. And yet now there's an EV plant there right, in Lordstown. But so why doesn't that break through? It's right there.
Well, I mean, this is what I tell people, because, I mean, this was the theory of the case. If you talked to Democratic leaders, especially behind the scenes, part of this was about climate change. Part of it is about fear of China. And part of it is about protecting democracy. Like, they're worried democracy is falling apart because of the sort of rage and resentment in these parts of the country that have been hollowed out by globalism. So very much the theory of the case was, if we just plow literal money and literal factories into exactly those places, that will answer that criticism. That will, you know what I mean? Like, that will get us credit from those people. But the thing is, even if a factory opens right next door to you, you don't necessarily know what it means. You need someone to tell you what it means. What is the larger story? Who's responsible? What is it? What is the larger policy goal of which it is a part? All that stuff, the sort of, you know, framing it for you, putting it in your worldview so you can make sense of it. You need help with that. You need media. You need trusted media figures. And if all your media figures are lying to you about everything, then the factory could open right next door. You could get a job at it and you could never know that Biden had anything to do with it. You know what I mean? If no one in the media you consume ever tells you, it doesn't matter how direct your experience is. You need everything is mediated. This is something I beat on again and again and again. There is no personal experience that's so direct that it doesn't involve some mediation by larger stories and larger narratives that you get from trusted figures. And if there's no room in that larger narrative for Biden to do anything good or for you to give credit to Biden, then it doesn't matter if Biden like came to your house and drove you to your new job. Like, it just wouldn't matter. You know, you need, unless you know how to think about it. So that's what I mean. Like, part of IRA should have been, and I think Democrats, you know, as usual, sort of fell down on this part of it, but like half of it should have been pushing out the factories, pushing out the money, and the other half should have been telling the story, hiring people to go there and tell the story. You know, like, you've got to, it's not going to tell its own story. That's what I guess is how I would summarize.
Pretty bleak. Well, let's bring this back to Trump ranting about wind power, right? So you don't really think he has a great chance of repealing all of IRA. Some of it would survive. What's a reasonable expectation here? I mean, in terms of how bad a Trump presidency would be for both Biden's climate agenda and for the kind of fate of, I guess, all of us.
The world. I mean, I wish I could be more nuanced for you, but it would just be horrible. It would be absolutely horrible and catastrophic. There's no, you know, I'm sorry, there's no, it's very disappointing, I think, to a lot of people, you know, our colleagues in media, but there's no cute counterintuitive take here. It would be horrible. And it would devastate the climate agenda, just like all the other agendas. Like I said, the international influence would be devastated. You know, all restrictions on fossil fuels would be permitted right and left and built right and left. Like, it would just be terrible. There's no, you know, there's no asterisks here. There's no but here. Like, it would be bad top to bottom.
Well, there you go. On that cheery note, right? I mean, the funny thing about this is that, you know, when he rants about wind, it's really ominous, right? It means something. It's not just Trump being crazy Trump.
Yes, yes. And the wind industry in particular needs help and reform right now. It needs new transmission. It needs, you know, lower interest rate loans. It needs a lot from policymakers right now, and it would not get it under Trump.
Certainly not. Well, David Roberts, thanks so much for coming on with us today.
Thanks, Greg.
You've been listening to The Daily Blast with me, your host, Greg Sargent. The Daily Blast is a New Republic podcast and is produced by Riley Fessler and the DSR Network.